So, okay. The heat has come to Baltimore. Yeah. Do you ever do this? I did this today, and I don't know why I do it sometimes, especially because I am a person whose AC breaks down in their car every once in a while. I got in the car, and it was boiling hot. And I was like, I'm just going to sit in it for a couple minutes. It's something really nice.
Do you know what I think it is about that? Is that it is very humid in Maryland, but in your car, it's not humid. So it feels more like desert heat. Yeah. It feels like you're in Arizona or like Southern California or Texas, as opposed to like the humidity where it feels like the air is like suffocating you. So I love that heat as opposed to humid heat.
Maybe that is it, because like I'm in there and I'm like, I feel like I'm in a sauna. Like I'm almost like,
I leave it like that.
Yeah. I left it like that for a couple minutes today. And then I was like, I should probably not sweat through all my clothes.
Maybe.
But, you know, but it felt kind of good.
You're in patterns. It's okay. You can show sweat, a little bit of sweat.
But yeah, I didn't know if other people felt that way. So if you do, let us know. But we're not here to talk about cars and heat.
Certainly not.
We're here to talk about Herstory.
On the rocks.
With Katie.
And Allie.
This is a podcast where we talk about famous women in history.
We talk about good women and bad women and fictional women and non-fictional women from all times and places, because women have nuance.
But keep in mind, we're drinking the entire time.
And we are not historians.
No.
We're barely human.
100%.
Yeah, so we're working our way through these stories.
Yes.
Sometimes we're putting them together at the last minute. I was ready early this week.
I was not. Yeah. I finished my research. I left the house at 3:30. I finished my research at 3:50.
It happens. Some weeks it's busier than others.
Yeah. Well, and also it was like I didn't realize how much historical context this story was going to take, because it takes place in the 1600s in England.
Uh-oh.
I was like, wow, there's
we're
a lot going on.
We're talking medieval times. Yuck.
Yeah. So a lot of Protestant and Catholic stuff going on in my story.
Yeah.
So I glaze over a lot of it, so you know, don't worry.
You know, religion is fraught with historical context.
But that being said, you know, we're not experts on this usually. So if we get something wrong with the fight between the Catholics and the Protestants, please let us know. Just email us. We love to get your feedback.
Right. Be like, my theology degree plus my medieval history like certificate
tell me this
says that you are wrong, and we will be like, we probably are wrong.
Yep,
thank you for that.
All right, but we know that you're busy because you are sitting in your car with the heat fully just engulfing you.
Yeah, and it's like that you just got off work and you're taking that 5 minutes to just sit silently.
Mm-hmm.
but we're talking to you. Right.
But you don't want to look at your phone,
open your eyes or anything like that. You're just like relaxing.
You're meditating
for a minute.
So you don't want to break that meditation by looking at your phone and looking at what these women look like.
No.
So we're going to describe them for you. We are going to get a little
physical.
Allie, who are you doing and what does she look like?
I'm doing Samira Musa. And she, there's pretty much like one, maybe two pictures of her, so it's kind of hard to describe. Samira is an Egyptian woman with a big, beautiful smile, excellent cheekbone / facial structure. She has eyes that seem to sparkle with wonder and short, curly, really dark brown hair that is pulled back half up, half down with like a poofy bang.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
That is what Samira looks like. Who are you doing and what does she look like?
I'm doing Nell Gwynn. Nell was a woman of very notable beauty. She had curly reddish hair that was very long, very flowy. She had dimples. She had very fair skin. In some of the portraits, it is like translucent white.
Whoa.
And she typically wore red lip. She is usually portrayed in very loose, flowy clothing, often with a lot of skin showing, sometimes even the tip of the nip. Risque.
Away.
So that's what she looked like.
Interesting. Well, I'm really excited to figure out what I'm drinking because it looks really delicious and refreshing.
Yes.
And with only 3 days of school left, you can imagine the kids are being fucking psycho.
Yeah,
so I could really take this drink.
So this is called the Mary Mistress. Mary spelled M-E-R-R-I-E. So this is tequila or mezcal. I wanted to get mezcal, but they didn't have anyone that wasn't insanely expensive at the store.
Sure.
So I did tequila. Mm. But it is that hot honey, apple cider vinegar, lime juice, and orange liqueur. And then you garnish with an orange slice.
Wow. Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers. It's so good. I love tequila. Mm-hmm. I know mezcal would make this taste a little bit different, mm-hmm. so I'd be interested to try that in the future.
Yeah.
Definitely good.
But it also might be too much with the hot honey, and because you are getting that like little kick yeah. from the hot honey.
Absolutely.
So.
Nice.
I wasn't sure how the apple cider vinegar was going to go, yeah. but I love it. All right, great. Well, what do you know about Nell Gwynn?
So I don't really know a lot about Nell Gwynn. You said a mistress. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, she was probably the mistress of someone important or as an, I don't know, 1600s. Let's see. We're like at the end of the Middle Ages and we're starting the Renaissance. And then also like, I feel like the Reformation is starting to go on.
Yeah. So we're in like we're in like the 1650s.
Okay.
To 1690s. So that's okay. kind of where we are in.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you said, there's a lot going on in Europe. Like kingdoms are starting to turn into like countries mm-hmm. and, you know, rulers are dictating what religion a country should be. And that is changing pretty often as per the King Henry VIII, who I think he was shortly before this in the 1500s. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I know a little bit about that time period, but I've never heard this woman's name before.
Okay, perfect. Well, she's super cool.
Okay.
but like a lot of women like her, her story is mainly told in like poetry and plays and kind of just like tall tales. So like we don't really know what 100% is true and what isn't. So, you know, as usual, you can take it with a grain of salt. But like I think her story is really fun. So I'm just going to take it all as completely true because I think it's fun. So let's get into it. Oh, and my sources are History Chicks and Wikipedia. There are a couple other podcasts that did episodes on her. But when I was listening to them, I was like, okay, like, you just had the Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, not in a bad way, but like, I was like, okay, I have that information, you know? Mm-hmm. And the History Chicks, they read a couple of like books on her, you know? Nice. So they had some more detailed information. So let's get into it. Eleanor Gwynn was possibly born on February 2nd. Hello, Zach and Olivia.
My Your brother birthday.
And sister in law have the same birthday.
Hello, Mr. Groundhog. Puxatani.
1650. Usually we don't even have that much information on these women, but Nell herself apparently gave that date as her birthday to an astrologer once. So we have that on record. Mm. On the other hand, there is an account published in the New Monthly Magazine and Humorist in 1838 that states she was born in 1842. And 8 years at this time period is a huge difference, especially when we're going to get into what she's getting into. But I more so believe the 1650 because it just makes more sense with like kind of how the story goes, frankly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm going to say 1650. Where she was born and who her father is are also up for debate. But most people think Oxford, England, and that her father was Captain Thomas Gwynn, who fought for the Royalists, which is not going to work out well for him. Her mother was a low-born woman named Ellen, who is believed to have lived most of her life in the West End. Most people referred to her as Ma Gwynn, and she had two daughters. The oldest one is Rose, and then there's Nell. Captain Thomas ended up in debtor's prison where he died, so Nell was raised with her sister by a single mother. Nell was born just after, you know, well, really in the midst of a very tumultuous time in England. They had just gotten out of their civil war, which was a clash between the parliamentarians and the royalists. Just 1 year before Nell's birth, King Charles I was deposed and beheaded for treason. His son, King Charles II, who should have taken over, fled out of the country because he was obviously not safe. This ended up being a 6-week journey where he almost died many times. But thankfully, some friendly souls helped him along the way. Like he'd be like in a field and a local farmer would be like, I'll hide you, you know, and he never forgot that. So that's very important to his story, this journey. He ended up in Paris to stay with his mother and his sister until things calmed down. He was 19 when this all happened. This was all overseen by Oliver Cromwell. He was a commander in the Parliamentary Army who then took over as Lord Protector of England. Some regard him as a hero of liberty and Puritan values. Others refer to him as a military dictator.
I feel like the Cromwell name was in a lot of the King Henry VIII
yes,
stories, right?
Because Thomas Cromwell was mm-hmm. like his big guy that he was fighting
right.
with a lot.
Okay.
And
okay,
I don't know if Oliver was his son or...
Maybe
like,
just in the family. Just like, in the family. It was probably a high nobility family.
Yeah, because I didn't look into him too much.
This is not a history podcast.
No. But one thing is for sure, England was a lot less fun with him around. Under Cromwell's rule, there were no theaters, no inns, no sports, no swearing. That was punishable by prison, prison time.
We'd be out of here.
No work on Sundays, no walking on Sundays except to church. Like, you could not go out for a leisurely stroll.
What a Chick-fil-A.
Mm-hmm. No makeup, no colorful dresses, no low-cut dresses because boobs are of the devil. No fun Christmas celebrations, only very serious religious ones. And the big feast days that they used to have honoring the saints, they're all fasting days now.
Ew.
Scotland was still technically under royal rule, but Ireland was under Cromwell. Catholicism here was banned, and the land belonging to Catholics was seized and given to Protestants.
What was the name of that censorship act in the Americas when, like, where they changed Betty Boop afterwards?
That's Hyde Act? Hayes. The Hayes Code.
That Cromwell is a regular old Hayes.
Yeah, because what is the guy? Oh, my God. So, yeah, there's the Hayes Code, and then there is the guy who was before that who always went after Margaret Sanger. Yeah. Comstock
walls. Yeah, he's a Comstock. Yeah, for definite sure. Comstock. I just, that name kept, like, on the tip of my tongue. With Cromwell.
Where it's just kind of like this thing of, like, I am going to force you to be pure like me, even though
he's probably breaking all sorts of church laws.
He was. Like, yeah. his daughter's weddings were, like, super fun affairs with lots of music and dancing, like, and everybody's like, we're not allowed to do that. And he goes, it's because you can't handle yourselves with this. Like, you'll be sinning the whole time. Whereas I'm doing it, but I'm not sinning.
Same.
We don't know. So this is, again, this is the world that Nell is being born into. And she's growing up in one of the poorest areas of London. And it's kind of funny because the way they were describing it was that the area that she's in, which is like the slums, it really didn't actually matter what was going on outside because they just kind of lived by their own rules, because at this point you could not control everybody from, like, going and, you know, hiring sex workers and going into brothels and, you know, drinking. Like, so they were just like, okay, you can do it here, but nowhere else. So they kind of got this pass just because it was so unruly.
Mm-hmm. Pirate ship rules, man.
Yes. So they were just like, yeah, we're just going to turn a blind eye to that corner. and again, we don't know too much about her mother, Ma Gwen, but given the time and the options for when at this time, and again, this seedy little area that they're in, it's believed that she was an alcoholic who ran a bawdy house. And a bawdy house was basically a brothel, but the women just kind of came there to work. They didn't live there like some of the other brothels. So it's not an ideal place for a child to grow up. And some say that Nell and Rose were made into child prostitutes here. It was kind of funny because my instinct is always to say sex worker, but I'm like, that doesn't apply to them because they're being forced into it. So I also don't know if I should refer to them as, like, trafficking victims. Like, yeah, it's wild. But yeah,
I mean, it's definitely child trafficking
yeah, for sure. But yeah, so she, you know, would have probably been working here doing that, or when she was around nine or working. I shouldn't have even said that. She is being forced to do that here when she's around 9 or 10. Others say that maybe she didn't do that. She was just working the bar. I don't know. Either way, though, she eventually became an oyster girl. She would go out into the street and sell oysters from her little basket. She also worked as a cinder girl selling cinders, which gained her the nickname Cindernell, which is so cute.
That is cute.
Because I didn't know that they would...
Cindernella!
Because I didn't know that this was a thing. They would literally go into, like, rich people's houses and clean the cinders, but then they would sell it because people could still start fires with, like, some of the stuff left over.
Oh.
So they're getting money for cleaning and selling the cinders, which is interesting. So...
kickbacks.
To put it simply, from a very young age, Nell had to be a hustler. She was... you know, working a lot, especially in the streets. And there were a lot of poor girls in London at the time working the streets. And you had to be really special to stand out. And Nell was one of those girls. Like, people paid attention to her because she was cute. She was charming. She was funny. Like, she was just a really, like, magnetic girl. But when Nell is 10 years old, things take a turn in England. King Charles II is invited to come back. Cromwell had died. And
we're
his...
just kidding.
Yeah. So Cromwell had died, and his son who took over for him was like, I don't want to do this anymore. Like, this is crazy. So they made a deal. that crown and parliament would share power. Similar to what's happening now.
Right.
So Charles comes back. He's 30, and he has a much broader view of the world than most kings do. He has seen the kindness of strangers, people in the poorest areas, people who he was told were his enemies, you know, people that he's like, they should have never shared any kindness to me. And they did. They helped me. So he's coming in with this like, okay, I don't want to be like a horrible tyrant. He wanted to bring peace and religious tolerance to England. His two big goals were no more war and let's have a good time. Thus, the age of merry old England began. This is also known as the Restoration Era. And Charles literally brought color, music, and dancing back to England. He's like, yes, let's get the colorful low-cut dresses back on the streets, take a walk on a Sunday, and most importantly for our story, go to the theater. Yes, the theaters are back. And he even establishes two theater companies. There's the King's Company. They operate out of a theater on Drury Lane, where the Muffin Man lives. And then there's Duke's Theater. This one was operated by the Duke of York, a.k.a. Charles's brother, James. And so this whole movement of like, let's have fun again, like, let's laugh, let's dance, this gained him the nickname the Merry Monarch. His own court was also known for its raucous behavior, and Charles became well known for his many mistresses. His first night back in town, he even chose to miss his welcome feast in order to hang out with his mistress, Barbara Palmer. So he wasn't officially married yet, but he made it clear from the get-go that he was going to have official mistresses just like they did in France. He actually ended up bringing a few other French things with him, including the fork.
Thank you.
He brought the fork to England, which apparently some of the people were like, that's disgusting. Like, I want to use my hands because they're the fork that God gave me.
Okay. This is just like people love to push back against new technology. Sorry. Use the fork. Yeah. You're disgusting. Like, you just the plague is only like 200 years old. Like, germs. Yeah. Gross.
The plague is coming in this story.
Like, again?
Yeah.
Great.
So... But again, the most important thing for our story is that he reopened the theaters. Nell had never lived in a world with theaters, so this was really exciting for her. And there was one more change that was really crucial. Women were now allowed to perform in theaters for the first time.
Mm.
Women's roles had been traditionally portrayed by men. It was believed that by keeping women off the stage, they would protect their modesty and their social standing, like... You know, it was just seen as, like, better for women to not let them do this.
Right.
But now things were different, and people were really excited for this new era in British theater. This also meant that people were clamoring to get into the theaters, especially the two royal ones, to become the official food vendors, because they knew that this was going to bring in a lot of money. And one of Nell's mom's friends, Mary Meggs, a.k.a. Orange Mall, got the contract to, quote, vend, utter, and sell oranges, lemons, fruit, sweetmeats, and all manner of fruitiers and confectioner's wares within the theater at the King's Company. So Nell, because she's a friend of her mom's, like, she got a job as an orange girl in the King's Theater. Mall knew that Nell was pretty enough, smart enough, and brave enough for this job, which required you to go toe-to-toe with drunk older men, you know, that were out for a good time at the theater. You had to charm them into buying an orange or whatever else food you had and keep them from getting too handsy with you or stealing your oranges. These girls were known for being beautiful and tough. There was even a saying that if you used bad language, you had a mouth like an orange girl.
Yes.
Nell and her sister Rose would stand between the stage and the pit, and as soon as there was a break in the play, they got to work selling food. They also had a side gig, so there's this whole other side business involved with being an orange girl. They became the go-betweens for rich men who wanted to take the beautiful actresses as their mistresses. This is a very common arrangement, and it would often be referred to as the men becoming their protectors. So protectors would protect these women in a way by giving them safety, reliable income, and even apartments. Like, I like to think of this as, like, in the first season of Bridgerton, what Antony has with the opera singer.
Yeah. She's like a kept mistress. Yeah.
Exactly. So like the girls would be the go-between for like guys arranging this kind of situation.
So they're like a booking agent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and this typically brought in a little more cash than the oranges.
Oh, just a little?
Just a little. And that's why like sometimes people are like, Nell was a child pimp. And like, I don't think she was a pimp. I think she was just sending notes back and forth and arranging some things. But yeah.
She's a bookkeeper.
Yes. She's a bookie, not a pimp. And soon Nell, who was again very beautiful, caught the eye of someone and gained a protector herself. There was a man named Robert Duncan who had moved Nell into her own apartment, so she wasn't living with her mother anymore. The flat was above a pub called the Cock and Pie. She was 12 years old. Which was the age of consent.
Wow.
Before they changed it to 13. So she's, but she's still working. So she's not a completely like kept girl. So she's slinging oranges. She has a protector. She's honestly at this point doing better in life than she ever thought she would. Right. So she is kind of excited.
I mean, she's comfortable.
Yeah, she's definitely like.
And in 1600s England, what could you ask for?
Yeah.
Other than comfort.
And we'll see this a lot. Like every time she's like, man, this is sweet what I got going on right now.
Yeah. I'm gonna take this gig.
But then another opportunity came up. The owner of the theater, Mr. Killigrew, is at a performance one night and he spots Nell. He is entranced by her and he's like, you should be on the stage, not standing in front of it. So he takes her backstage and tells the older veteran male performers, Charles Hart and John Lacey, to train her for the stage. Charles' specialty was drama and John's was comedy. So she's getting to learn both crafts. But comedy definitely came a little easier to her. They taught her how to move around the stage, how to express emotion. And since she was illiterate, they literally had to teach her lines phonetically, which, of course, was a process. Charles also, though, ended up falling for Nell and took the place of her protector.
So she's moving up in the world. Bigger and better boys. Mm-hmm. Okay.
She's 14 right now.
Got it.
So she's out of her flat at the Cock and Pie, and she's now living with Charles Hart. And this is a fine arrangement for Nell. It even helped her for her performances because she and Charles developed this banter, which the audience loved. They absolutely ate it up. But even without Charles, the audience loved Nell. She was a real natural on stage. She was funny, but then she could break your heart. She was also really good at improv, and she would kind of break the fourth wall a lot and like bring the audience in. She'd be like, you know me, Nell. Isn't this play crazy?
Do you know, I think probably her early life, like working in the streets and having to go toe-to-toe with adults, probably made her very quick-witted.
100%. I think it also gave her a sense of like, what do people want to hear? What do they not want to hear?
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you can read an audience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For sure. So Nell is enjoying her new position on the stage. Meanwhile, King Charles II has gotten married to the Princess of Portugal, Catherine of Braganza. This is great for England, brought a lot of trade opportunities. She came with a huge dowry, but it's probably not the best for Catherine since Charles was very open about maintaining his mistresses and he already had 5 illegitimate sons with them. He even brought his favorite mistress, Barbara Palmer, to meet Catherine. And he's like, Catherine, this is Barbara. Barbara, this is Catherine. Just so you know, Catherine, I made Barbara a countess and her official title here is Mistress of the Bedroom. So yeah, just want to let you know about all that. Catherine fainted. She was like, I don't know what to do with this information, especially because her mom, who knew that he had this reputation, was like, don't let him do this to you. And so she's like, you can't. And he goes, yes, I can. And she goes, okay.
I mean, like, he's the king.
He's the king. Like, he's the king. Can't tell him what to
do. Like, what are you going to do? He can just get rid of you.
Yeah. This poor girl. I mean, she didn't speak the language. She had no power here. So she was just like, I'm just going to go along with it. Also, around this time, no matter how much he tried to avoid it, a war did break out with the Netherlands, which, fun fact, led to New Amsterdam becoming New York here in the States, or the colonies, and it was named after the king's brother, James, who was the Duke of York.
Mm.
Then, to make matters worse, the plague breaks out. 20% of the population died. This is a really brutal time. And again, like, I feel like the plague, like, comes and goes during these years.
It,
like,
goes through a cycle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the cycles. Most of the theaters ended up closing during this time, and the king fled to Oxford to escape the plague. But he needed some entertainment, so he brought the whole King's Theatre Company with him, which, of course, now includes Nell. So that's nice to have some job security.
I mean, he's quarantining. It's great.
Mm-hmm. So after the winter, it kind of cooled things down in London. The plague is not as bad. The king and the theater company come back. Society comes back. Nell is 16. She's back on the stage in London, and the people were really happy to see her. By this time in her career, she was one of the most popular actresses on the stage. She had playwrights writing plays specifically for her. And they would often, funny enough, write parts that involved her being a woman on stage, but having her female character have to dress like a man during some point in the story, because at this point in history, men wore like these little like shorts and they had tights on underneath. And so the audience loved to see Nell's legs. Ooh, because she had really good legs.
Girl, yes.
From walking around slinging those oysters.
Her calves are fit.
So career's going well. Then a huge fire breaks out in London on Pudding Lane, and it burned for 4 days, destroying most of the old city of London.
Cool.
They just can't catch a break. According to the official record, only 8 people died. Historians don't quite believe this, but it left 200,000 people homeless. Like, this is absolutely devastating. London is fucked again. The theaters close again. Bad for Nell. And bad for Charles, because people start to blame the Catholics for the fire. So religious tensions are sprouting up again. And he's like, this is not what I want. I just want to have a good time. Yeah. Oh, my God. So,
I mean, I think, like, in London, like, you still can't have buildings with thatch roofs. Mm-hmm. Like, you still can't have certain things made out of wood because of this fire.
Makes sense. Life goes on, though. And eventually the theaters reopened. But now, there was a bit of a rivalry between the King's Theater and the Duke's Theater. So these were two different companies, which meant that there was a rivalry between their two leading ladies. Nell's competition is a woman named Moll Davis. And Moll Davis had a famous song that she would sing. And the lyrics went, "My lodging, it is on the cold ground. And oh, very hard is my fare. But that which troubles me most is the unkindness of my dear. Yet still I cry, oh, turn, love, and prithee, love, turn to me, for thou art the man that I long for, and alack, what remedy?" So it's basically like, I'm just a poor woman that wants love, and people fall for it hook, line, and sinker every time. And from what I gather, like, what Moll had that Nell didn't was she had the drama side, like, really down. Mm. And she would really move people.
Able to make people, like, fall in love with her.
Yeah, and Nell was more of a comedian, you know? Like, she was kind of like the... It's kind of like Kristen Bell versus, like, Michelle Williams, you know?
Yes, understood.
King Charles saw her perform this song and fell for her. He invited her back to his bedchambers, and she was the new prized mistress. People in court were shocked because this was the first common woman he had taken to be mistress.
Oh, so they had all been nobility to this point.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And Nell was kind of pissed because now her main rival has landed a whale and, like, as a protector. And, like, you literally cannot get a higher protector than the King of England.
Right. Yeah.
And it also meant that Moll was becoming more popular in England because people wanted to know about the king's mistress. So Nell decided that, and of course, she was getting, like, a super huge head about it, Moll, because she's still working. So she's still around the theater scene and just, like, annoying the hell out of Nell.
I can imagine hating that in the workplace.
Yep. So Nell decided that she needed to be taken down a peg. So she and her composer friend wrote a little rebuttal to her famous song, making fun of her. I couldn't find the full lyrics to it. And then I couldn't hear exactly what they were saying on the History Chicks podcast. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to write it down wrong. There was, like, one word in particular I couldn't get.
It's
so
like
anyways.
It's a rap battle.
Yeah.
For sure.
So she makes a song making fun of her. It's going crazy. Then in a weird twist, Charles Hart, so her current protector still, she and him have been together for a little bit now.
Probably, yeah.
He starts having an affair with Barbara Palmer.
Oh, ex-prized mistress.
Well, she's still a favorite mistress, you know, but she's kind of like the old reliable, you know, the Rachel Weisz mistress.
She's aging a little.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, so she's still there, but, you know, she's kind of like, oh, okay, like, you like this new little actor girl. And she also was kind of pissed because she was like, she's a commoner. Like, so it kind of made her feel like she was on the same level as an actress, mm-hmm. which really pissed her off. So she was like, okay, well, I'm going to take a commoner into my beds. Like, I can do it too. Like, I don't know if the king actually cared.
I don't think Charles cared. He does not care.
Yeah. So, yeah, so they're starting to have an affair. Nella's still living with him, but she also has a ton of suitors herself. You know, like, they had a very, like, open kind of situation. And one of her suitors was Lord Buckhurst, and she ended up moving in with him while the theaters were closed during yet another war for a little bit. And they were, again, very open with their relationship, but they would act a little bit more like a couple for this, like, short period of time. They would host parties together. They went on holiday together. And this was, like, a really fun period, and it was a step up for her. But it was also kind of bad because she was like, wow, I'm, like, really getting used to, like, being inside the world of wealth and privilege for an extended period of time. You know, it's not quite the same as, like, going and hanging out for a little bit or like a night or two. This is like a couple months. And she's like, this is really nice. I'd love for this to last longer. So they fizzled out though after a couple months. The theaters opened back up and she went back to her old life. And she was like, you know what? I have kind of a new mission. I want a more permanent protector who can kind of set me up for life. I don't want to have to work for the rest of my life.
She's going for a pension here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
She literally gets one.
Yeah. Yes, girl.
Shortly after all this, the King's Company and the Duke's Company all went to a spa town so that the Queen could relax, heal, and hopefully produce an heir. Because during all of this, poor Catherine of Portugal cannot conceive.
Well, it's probably because she has whatever.
Syphilis.
Yeah,
most definitely.
Because he's just having sex with everybody, giving her syphilis, and then she can't conceive a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's such a bummer.
Yeah, it is.
So this meant that Nell was stuck on a trip with her rival, Moll, who just kept going on and on about her relationship with the king. How great it was. How big the ring was that he got her. How pretty the dresses were. Everyone was sick of her. I mean, even the queen and Barbara Palmer, the other woman in this situation, they walked out of her performances very publicly because she was not really following the rules of etiquette for a king's mistress.
Yeah.
You know, she was like really spraying it all over town. And everyone was like, this is not how you do it. So
I think we've covered that there are right and wrong ways to be a mistress on this show several times.
For
and
sure.
Like, one of them was, remember that woman who was married, I think, to like a king of France, and she came to this party wearing like a dress with hearts all over it, like right in the queen's face.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I cannot remember who that was
either, but it was like, that is a big no-no. Like, you're supposed to be quiet about your relationship, even though people know, because it's still like hush hush, because it's insulting to the queen.
Yes.
Or the lady or the duchess or whoever it is.
For sure. So then Moll was telling everyone under the sun that she and Charles were taking things a step further. They were going to have dinner together.
She's lying.
No, she wasn't. This was actually happening.
They're having dinner.
They're going to have dinner
like
together.
Like Beauty and the Beast style at a big table. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, this is the mistress version of he asked me to go study with him.
Oh.
Like, he gave me his class ring.
Oh, we're not
like,
just talking anymore.
No, it's this getting serious.
Yeah.
Nell is sick of this. So she's like, I'm going to screw her over. Because also, I don't think...
Extra pages.
Just a couple of blank pages. That's fine. The story does continue.
That's symbolic of the things we don't know about.
Yeah. Seriously. So I think she was also just like, you're not being a good girl. Like, you're not being a girl's girl. Like, I hate you. So then she is not being a girl's girl. And she decides to screw Moll over.
Listen, I really love vindictive. I love people who can hold a good grudge.
Yep.
I love people who are going to go in and screw you over.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want that to happen to me.
No.
And I
God,
only
no.
do it to a very few select people. But it is, when you do it and you do it to the right person, it is beautiful.
Yeah. So Nell had her friend, a playwright and spy, Afra Ben. I've never heard of this woman before, but she sounds super cool. she has this woman make her some powder from the jollop weed plant. And what this plant does, if you ingest it, is it induces bowel movements.
Ooh, she gave her laxatives? No! Laxatives to the mistress!
Nell laces some treats with the powder invites Maul over for tea. And Maul is like, these are delicious. And she eats a ton of them on the day of her big dinner with the king.
Oh, girl, watch your figure.
And of course, it kicks in during her date with the king, which resulted in everyone's worst nightmare. Literal diarrhea, like, while having... So crazy.
While in the act?
I don't think in the act. Dinner. I think during dinner. Again, we don't have too many details.
It's hard to get those hoop skirts out of the way. Like, what? I mean, what? Whoa.
Yeah, so this cooled the relationship down significantly.
You can't come back from that one as a mistress. Your whole job is to be endlessly sexy.
Yeah.
There can't be anything real.
No.
That's why you can't actually date a mistress, because then it becomes not sexy.
Exactly. So now it's time for Nell and Charles's meet cute. So obviously they're around each other.
Grocery
they know each other.
Aisle.
But like
cart runs into it.
So one night Nell has the night off. So she goes out to a play, then she goes out to the local tavern, and she spots the king and the duke incognito. They're having a night on the town like regular people. Jasmine style.
Secrets. Don't touch the apples. They cut off hands for that. Wow.
So this is all fine and dandy until the bill comes and they don't have any money. Again, very Jasmine.
So Jasmine. Oh my God, what a dummy.
So they're kind of panicking because they're like, we've never had to carry cash before. Nell walks over the table
and goes,
very
your privilege
cool.
is showing.
So she goes, she wanted to catch their attention and let them know that like she was onto them, but she wasn't going to blow their cover. So she used one of the king's favorite phrases that like only people who are like around him would know, which... It's odd fish. This is the poorest company I was ever in. So she says that, kind of winks at him, and then just pays the bill and walks out.
What a fucking power move.
I know.
Also, like, if that wasn't the king, that would have been so weird. Can you imagine you said that and paid, and it's a random guy, and they're like,
what
was that lady? That was weird.
He was impressed. Number one, it was a slick move. Number two, she didn't rat him out. So he's like, okay, she's super cool. And now he is asking about her. And he invites her into the bedchambers and invites her to join the ranks of mistresses. She caught her whale and gave Maul Davis, or whatever her name was, I don't even remember her last name, the finger all the way up.
Hell yeah.
I meant to like double check what her last name was when I wrote that, and I couldn't remember.
This is not her story right now.
No, it's not. So... she started as kind of like the lowest level of mistress right now. Like it's the most casual. Like they're basically just like friends with benefits, like nothing super serious. But soon they started getting closer and they found that they really enjoyed each other's company. And Nell decided not to take any more lovers during this time because she was like starting to like really feel something for Charles. This also boosted Nell's career even more because, again, people love to see the king's mistress perform. And she even got a boost in her social standing. People now refer to her as Mrs. Nell Gwyn instead of Miss. And it wasn't, I didn't realize that it wasn't a marriage thing. It was a respectability thing at first. So this is all very exciting. Charles enjoyed being in her company because Nell was really fun. Barbara Palmer was always trying to navigate some political thing. Maul was mainly into the notoriety and the gifts. Bragging about it. Again, just like kind of the title of the king's mistress is what she was interested in. Mm-hmm. But Nell, she was fun. She made him laugh. They would do things like go swimming in the river. And they would go fishing together. Like once he wasn't catching any fish. So she did the whole like... look over there. And she put a piece of fried fish on the end of his hook and was like, you did it.
She was just like leading him through like the commoner lifestyle.
Yeah. I mean, they would literally put on disguises together and she would like, you and your brother don't know what you're doing. So I'm going to show you how it's done. And they would go and they would talk to people and they would bet on horse races together. And like, they would just have this really nice easy time together. She even got close to his siblings. She would razz the Duke of York, calling him Dismal Jimmy because he was like often kind of shy and reserved. And she even got close with his sister, and she would send her gifts from France. Her name was Henrietta, but she was known as Minette. And most importantly, she never brought up politics or anything serious. He started commissioning portraits of her, some fully clothed, some not so much.
Yeah, I saw some pictures. Perky boobs. Perky. Full out.
Soon, Nell found herself in the family way. She was pregnant, and she gave birth to her first child in 1670 and named him Charles. She is 20 years old right now. I have to remind everybody that. Whoa! Remember, we started this out and she was...
I forgot that she was like 10 when she was slinging oranges.
Yes. And she is now the favored mistress of the king. And, you know, she has his baby. So she's receiving gifts from all over the world, from dignitaries congratulating her. Like, it's pretty exciting. But while she's giving birth, Minette, the sister, dies. And... this is really traumatic for Charles. He's really upset. And he ends up making one of her ladies-in-waiting his mistress. So this was a woman named Louise. And she was her, like, lady-in-waiting over in France, because that's where Minette was living. And it kind of seemed like he mainly brought her in to grieve with her, because it was someone that knew his sister well. And it's kind of funny, because obviously, like, he has his wife. He has Barbara Palmer. He has other women that he's sleeping with. But, like, this was the thing that kind of made her jealous, because the connection that they had was more personal than his other woman. And this is the most personal, you know, like this is someone he's bringing in to help him through a hard time. So she's getting kind of jealous. And also, like, she just had birth. She just gave birth. She's in kind of a precarious position, you know. So she kind of makes a point, and she's like, all right, well, like, I'm going to go back to the stage then. Because, like, really, she was his favored mistress, but she didn't have anything concrete, you know? Mm-hmm. So she's like, all right, I'm going to go back to the stage, which is a bad look for the king to have his main mistress, like, still performing.
And leave him.
Yeah.
Kind of like. It looks like I dumped you.
Uh-huh. You know, it's kind of like this, oh, like, your woman has to work. Like, you're not keeping her well enough.
Right.
So he puts a stop to that pretty quickly. And he's like, okay, we'll make this for real. And he buys her a house across the street from his palace at Whitehall and sets her up with a pension. She could finally breathe. This setup came with a lot more stability, and she wasn't worried about Charles just breaking up with her and having to go back to scraping by. So she officially retires from the theater. She's 21 years old. This ended up being a great thing for Charles, too, because Nell made her house into a really fun place. It was filled with friends and music and food. I mean, all her friends are theater people, so you know they're really down for a good time. And it ended up being kind of a retreat for Charles. At Nell's place, he wasn't the king. He was just a guy having a good time with his friends. Charles also ends up using her house as his secret meeting place, because there's no one to eavesdrop into their conversations like in the palace. So this is a really, like, safe space for him. She even got to decorate the place, which was really fun. She put floor-to-ceiling mirrors in the foyer and had a silver bed custom made. complete with a silver bed warmer with "Fear God, Serve the King" engraved on it.
Whoa! Okay, so wait, a silver...
A classic from Things Remembered.
Oh, yeah, she got it at the mall, kiosk. A silver bed frame. That's expensive. Is it just silver plated, or it's made from silver? It's
cast from silver. I think they said it weighed like 850 pounds.
And wait, imagine trying to get it off the steps. They have to cast it in the room. Yeah. Right? No.
They would. I guess they must have, like, really put it together in there.
There's no, like, forklifts.
Yeah.
They're not getting it up through a window. They're going to shatter that glass in the foyer if they drop it down the steps. There's a whole lot of stuff happening.
There's a lot going on.
Also, like, what? Wait, what is he again?
Fear God, serve the king.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Nell was also smart in that she had the king put the house in her name. It took her a few years to convince him of this, but it was really important to her. Because, again, she's like, I know how this goes. If you die, nothing. This could all go away in an instant if this is not in my name. Mm-hmm. So she was really trying, because like obviously she loved him and cared about him, but she also wanted to protect herself, especially now that she has kids.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, I really need to do this.
She's not trying to go back to being a working girl.
No. And soon she did have a second son, James, named after his uncle, Dismal Jimmy. So she has a second son. French mistress Louise is still around, and she gets made a duchess and is given a 24-room suite in the palace. And Nell is still
a little bitter.
Jealous. Yeah, I'm bitter and a little bitter.
That. I'm bitter about that. Because
she doesn't have a title.
Oh.
And every other mistress did. Obviously, except like Maul didn't get one. That was too short-lived. But
well,
you know,
the diarrhea really took her out of the running.
Yeah. But everybody else had titles, and she was like, okay, like she's been around for like 2 seconds. Like, what the hell? But thankfully, what she does have is the people on her side. They really hate Louise. There's even this very funny story of the king's carriage going through the streets, and people think it's Louise inside, and they start yelling, Catholic whore!
Yeah,
at the carriage.
They hate the French man in England.
But it's actually Nell inside, so she stops the carriage and comes out, and she goes, good people, you are mistaken. I am the Protestant whore.
Yeah. Yes. Know yourself. Know thyself. Isn't that a Bible verse? Yeah.
The crowd loves this, and they start cheering for Nell. And the people, they just loved her because she was one of them, and she actually made it to a better life. Another funny coach story was apparently her coachman got into a fight with a guy because the guy called her a whore, and she popped out of the carriage and said, look, I am a whore. Find something else to fight about.
Yeah. Pick a new insult.
She knew herself. She was like, I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm here. I'm aware of what's happening. But one other thing that Louise got that Nell didn't was titles for her children that she had with the king. Nell had 2 sons, and she was not even given a surname for them, which was really annoying to
her. It's upsetting. Why this woman from France? I guess she was noble anyway.
She was noble.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And she was fine with not receiving a title for herself, but she was like, I need titles for my sons. Like, I put them in this situation, so, like, I want them to have a better life.
And you are their fucking dad.
Yeah. And so one day, Charles came over to visit, and she calls Charles Jr. down, and it's like, come here, you little bastard, your dad's here. Oh. And Charles is like, what the fuck? He goes, don't call our son a bastard. And she's like, well, you haven't given me anything else to call him. A month later, he had a title. He was made the Earl of Burford with the surname of Beauclerc. And eventually, he was made the Duke of St. Albans, which is a title that is still in use.
That's cool to know that, like, you are a noble and you have a title because your great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was a mistress. That's the only kind of title, yeah. I want. That's the kind of nobility that I would want to be.
Yep.
Meanwhile, I'm probably from, like, the Massachusetts Bay people. I'm probably, like, my family's, like, murdering witches. What a boring background.
So, James, the younger one, wasn't given a title quite yet, but he did get to share the surname Beauclerc. Nell was pretty satisfied with this. Actually, she's pretty satisfied with everything right now. She was stoked when she went from Oyster Girl to Orange Girl, so this is really excellent. Which is why when the king got another new noble mistress, a woman named Hortense, I cannot believe.
Hortensia?
This name came up. I think it's Betty Ford's mom's name was, yeah, Hortense.
Like last week.
Yeah.
And you're like, I haven't heard that word before.
Never heard it before. And it's come up twice now.
Yeah.
Because it's not Hortensia. It's Hortense.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyways. So Hortense comes in, another noble mistress. But she wasn't really too stressed. She was like, I got what I wanted out of the situation. Like, I'm happy. Like, I have my house. My kids have titles.
Pension.
I have a pension. And Charles and I are still getting along. Like, I still like him. Like,
yeah,
I'm still
friends.
Very much in love with him.
Yeah.
So she's, like, not upset. Louise, however, is freaking out. Louise starts beefing with Hortense, and things are getting really tense in the palace.
Love Island.
Mm-hmm.
Love and Castle.
Charles actually comes to Nell and is like, what should I do? How do I stop this? And she goes, put away your codpiece.
Put your dick in your pants, buddy.
I love this because also, like, Charles thought it was so fucking funny.
Yeah.
Like, he is laughing at this. He really liked her. And you know who else liked her? Queen Catherine. Catherine likes her. And there are a couple reasons for this. Number one, Nell was just trying to stay in her lane. She was like, I'm going to be the best mistress. You know, I'm cool in my role. I'm not trying to be queen. And I'm not trying to make you feel bad that your husband has a mistress. And second most important was that Charles was usually in a better mood when Nell was around because he liked her. He felt comfortable with her. He was more relaxed. And Catherine really appreciated when her husband was in a better mood.
Yeah.
Like everybody does. And
let's face it, if he could stick to just these two girls, he would stop giving his wife syphilis.
Yeah.
And then she could bear some children.
Seriously. So these were the two women out of all who wanted the best for Charles. And it kind of bonded them that like that was their goal. Like everyone else's were very superficial. And of course, like Nell also wanted to get what she got out of this whole thing. You know, she was like, I'm going to get mine like while I'm here. But also I want Charles to be happy, which I don't think was really a concern of the other mistresses. When Nell is 29 years old, her mother dies after, this is really sad, falling in a ditch and drowning when drunk. She's in her 50s. And even though Nell and her mother obviously had some issues because of her childhood, she still respected her mom. And she decided to throw her a real big fancy funeral where she and her friends literally processed through the streets of London, handing out beer to people so they could toast Ma Gwen, which I thought was so cute. This was hard on Nell, but then an even bigger blow came. Her son James was on a trip with his tutor to Paris when he died suddenly at 9 years old.
No.
It just said like a sore in his leg. So I don't know if it got infected.
Maybe like MRSA?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But he's dead. Nell is devastated. And Christmas was always really hard because that was James's birthday.
Oh.
I know. The king eventually also gave Burford Hall to Nell, which is next to Windsor Castle. And this was their country retreat together. And they would relax and they would play with their dogs. They had a whole bunch of King Cavalier Spaniels, Charlotte's dog from Sex and the City. Mm-hmm. I think that's what they're called. King Spaniels?
Hold on. Cocker Spaniel?
King Charles Spaniel. Okay. That's what they're called.
Named no after cocker. Him, I guess.
King Charles. Oh, yeah. I guess so. So, yeah. So they have a bunch of those dogs and they have an orangery. So they're eating fresh oranges. Like she's like, oh, how far I've come. Like, this is so great.
I used to sling these. Yeah. Now I just get them.
As I said earlier, she was the people's mistress. They loved her because she was kind and she used her newfound position and power to give back to the people of London. She gave generously and anonymously to the church that her mother attended. One time she came across a man who was being harassed by tax collectors and she stepped in and screamed at the tax guys and paid his taxes for him to be like, get away from him. In another instance, she saw a poor wounded soldier out of her window. And after helping him get some care, she had an idea that she brought to the king. And again, she does not normally ask him for things like this, but she was like, this is really important. She was like, I think we should have a hospital dedicated solely to veterans. She was like, these are people that fought for you.
Talk about changing the world.
Literally.
Psycho. That's psycho.
He said, okay. And so they start planning for this veterans hospital. And while they're mapping it out and making the plans, apparently she got a big piece of fabric and laid it over the blueprints and was like, it should be this big. Like double it. This would eventually become the Chelsea Military Hospital, which still exists today.
That's
so cool.
That's so incredible. I can't believe that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And again, these are all stories. So like maybe it's not true, but I'm going to believe that it is.
And also it's like why commoners should be allowed to intermix with royals.
100%.
You have a different understanding of the world around you.
Yeah.
And I mean, Charles technically should have too, because he spent some teenage years really struggling. So that's probably why he was open to suggestions like this.
I think so. Yeah. I think absolutely. On Nell's 35th birthday, Charles became ill. He collapsed and he died after 4 days. He had plenty of children, tons of sons, but alas, none with Catherine, so the throne was being passed to his brother, James. Some of his last words to James were, "Let not poor Nelly starve." And James was happy to do so, because Nell was always sweet to him. Like, a lot of people treated him differently because he was kind of shy and reserved, but, like, Nell just was always, like, trying to bring him in, and he really appreciated that. and he knew that she was always faithful and good to his brother. I mean, she even wrote in a letter to James after his death. She was like, I'm so upset, like, da 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 da. And she just goes, he was my friend, which is so heartbreaking. I mean, they'd been together for 26 years at this point. That's right. A long time.
And since she was a child.
Yeah. Nell was well taken care of, as promised. Louise was sent back to France.
Get the fuck out, they said.
But even though things were good on paper, Nell was really grieving, and her health started to go downhill. When she was just 37, she had a stroke. 2 months later, she had another one. And within 2 years of Charles' death, on November 14th, 1687, Nell Gwynn passed away. Some say the strokes were caused by a broken heart. Others say syphilis. She was buried with her mother at St. Martin in the Fields Church, and her funeral was greatly attended by people from literally all walks of life across London. Like, it was literally like the poorest of the poor were there and the wealthiest nobles were there. I mean, the new king was there. Like, this was the most well attended funeral.
And how old is she again when she died?
She was 37. Oh, wow. Maybe not 30, maybe 39.
Around that late
30s. Oh, yeah. No, she was, 37 when she died.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So not that old.
And is this is King James of King James Bible, right?
I think so,
yeah. The Shire Reserve Fund.
She put in her will that she wanted Thomas Tennyson, the future Archbishop of Canterbury, to perform her funeral service. But she also added a note that said, if it was going to harm his reputation, like, don't worry about it. Like, you know, I won't be upset. It's not worth it for you to lose your social standing to do the funeral of a mistress. But he happily agreed to do it. And at the funeral, he pointedly read this verse, Luke 15:7. Just so I tell you, there will be no more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Mm. And actually, when he was up for the Archbishop of Canterbury position, they looked at that and they're like, that's actually a godly man who would do this. You know, like, that's actually what, like, a truly Christ-like character would be. Mm-hmm. She left most of her money to her son, but also left money to the poor and put in her will that £50 be used every Christmas to release people from debtor's prison.
Oh, in honor, like, of her son. That's really sweet.
Yeah. And her dad, who died in debtor's prison. Like, she's like, that's not okay. Like, people should not die in debtor's prison. Like, right. That's so awful.
Because how the fuck are you going to pay your debts?
If you're in prison, it's so ridiculous.
It's stupid. It's so stupid.
In 1937, a new 10-story block of 437 flats on Sloane Avenue, Chelsea, was given the name Nell Gwynn House. And in a high alcove above the main entrance is a statue of Gwynn with a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel at her feet. This is believed to be the only statue of a royal mistress in London.
That's so cool. I just got chills at that. That's awesome.
So even though she never received a title, she still holds a very important place in the hearts of the people of England.
That's incredible. And also, like, I wonder what kind of an impact she had on James. Because, like, I feel like the King James Bible, when it got translated, it was put in the common tongue for the first time. So it's like people had access to the Bible that didn't before. And, like, I wonder if some of that is, like, him interacting with her as a non-noble.
Yeah.
On a regular basis. Remember, like,
I don't know if she ever learned how to read. She's an illiterate woman who is in the palace. Like, you know? Like, I think that she made a difference to a lot of people because she was nice, she was friendly, and I just think she had a really good heart.
Yeah.
And I think that she made a huge difference, probably bigger than we might ever know.
And also, she would not suffer fools.
No. God, no.
She was like, get this bitch out of here. I also thought that, like,
she has a huge heart, but she also gave someone diarrhea on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, but that's what I mean. Someone. Like, she had a big heart unless she openly saw somebody not having a big heart, in which case she was like, I will fight you.
Yeah.
Because you are an imposter of my kind. Yeah.
So that was Nell.
That was really cool. That was really, really cool. I love that story. Mine has literally nothing in common. This is going to be crazy difficult. All right. I wrote some things down, but it's going to be nuts. All right. Let's go make a drink.
All right.
Okay.
We're back
new drink.
Pink drink. Very exciting. Pinkish yeah, red.
This is a take on an Egyptian martini.
Ooh, I've never heard of this before.
I know. And it is 2 ounces of vanilla vodka, a half an ounce of triple sec, some simple syrup, muddled up red raspberries. You shake it over ice, pour it in the glass, and then you put on a cocktail stick, fresh raspberries and a maraschino cherry.
Perfect. Cheers. Cheers. Mm. The raspberry taste is so strong. I think it's because it's fresh,
muddled raspberries.
Muddled raspberries.
And I love it because it was supposed to be raspberry liqueur. Mm. And I was like, I would really, because that's what's really in an Egyptian martini. It's raspberry liqueur, triple sec, and vanilla vodka. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what if I just did simple syrup to substitute the sweetness of the liqueur and put in some good stuff in
I love the fresh raspberry taste, which again, like I love a liqueur, but like you just don't get that taste with it.
Yeah. And the cocktail is called Adams for Peace.
Ooh, okay.
Okay, so do you want to tell me what you know about Samira Musa?
Nothing.
Great. Because I didn't either on Monday, and then I researched.
All right, perfect.
So I read a couple things, obviously the Wikipedia, and then I watched a YouTube video called The Madame Curie of Egypt.
Okay.
And I read an article called How a Physicist Went from Mystery to Role Model.
Cool.
So cool stuff. So let's set the scene. The word nuclear is big and it's scary. Mm-hmm. It's Chernobyl. It's radiation. It's the atom bomb. It's the Cold War. And like when I picture it, I picture destructive, mm-hmm. right? And that's how most people felt at the end of World War II. For the first time, scientists saw the true destructive power of nuclear explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, you know, the post-war arms race really put the public, like, in a moment of unease, with scientists working with different governments around the world to, like, out-nuclear one another. Mm-hmm. Okay. The genie is out of the bottle. Mm-hmm. The world knows, like, we need to draft policies. We need to figure out who can and can't have this power, who can and can't be a nuclear threat. And they're using a lot of that, like, political know-how to spin it into things like clean energy and medical advancements, which is what we should be using nuclear power for, but, like, aren't. Mm-hmm. Let's back up. Ultimately, there's few records about Samira's life. Most are secondhand accounts. Many are built off of rumors. So we have to be cautious about like whether or not these are true. But much like your story, I'm going to try to accept that many of them are very, very true.
Yeah.
Samira was born in Egypt in 1917, north of Cairo. Her mom died when she was really young from cancer. So she was a single, she had a single father, Musa Ali. He was, some say, a famous political activist. But after mom dies, they kind of pick up and they move to Cairo. And he invests his money in opening a small hotel. Mm-hmm. Her father insisted that she attended primary school, and she became a student in the oldest school in Cairo. After completing her primary education, she joins a school that was built and managed by her dad so that she can kind of be in secondary education. She got really, really high grades in like the high school sphere and could have pursued things like engineering in the private sector to make a ton of money. But she insists on studying the sciences at Cairo University. This is 1939.
Wow.
When she is going to obtain a bachelor's of science in radiology at Cairo University. She had decided to research the effects of X-ray radiation on various materials, and she could not have picked a better field of study at the time. X-rays were becoming a popular tool in many hospitals and private practices. People are writing about them in peer-reviewed journals, so it gives her a chance to maybe be a published, like, you know, college professor slash student. And also, like, Europe was more experienced. And obviously, Egypt, right next to Europe. We forget sometimes that Northern Africa is, like, a second away. Mm-hmm. Europe is really experienced with X-rays because Marie Curie had that mobile X-ray, like, thing that she was moving around to battlefields in World War One. So, also with me, I keep bringing up Marie Curie this season.
Yeah.
It's, like, a reoccurring theme for me. So while Samira is researching radioactive isotopes used to create medical imaging, she kind of creates a version of it that's still used today in X-ray machines around the world. So this is when she is like just has her bachelor's and working in the university as like a 20-year-old. Like,
that's crazy.
Figuring out X-rays so that we still can take good pictures of our bones.
Wow.
So a guy named Dr. Mustafa Musaharafa was the dean of the faculty, and he believed in her so much that he helped her become a lecturer at the university instead of just a student. She was the first woman anywhere to hold this role at a university in Egypt while getting her PhD. So she doesn't have a PhD yet, and she's already lecturing. This was nearly impossible at the time because not only were women kind of held back from doing this all over the world and in Egypt, but primarily in Egypt, professors were British, not of like national origin, Egyptian. So afterwards, she ends up doing such a great job that she becomes an assistant professor at the same university and is the first woman to hold a university post in Egypt and the first to obtain a PhD in atomic radiation. At the university.
Wow.
Yeah, in all of Egypt. So that's pretty cool. She authors and co-authors a whole bunch of papers that communicate the theory behind nuclear energy and how to use it to impact the world safely. She also wrote about the history of the atom and its structures and the dangers of nuclear fission technology, as well as the properties of radiation and their biological effects. She even began writing a book about the Muslim scientist that founded algebra. So if you remember, we've talked a lot about the early universities in like the golden age of Islam that were built. And she is very intrigued about writing about those people because she is now an Egyptian scientist and she's looking back and seeing these Egyptian learned scientists and mathematicians and being like, there don't only need to be British professors in my country.
For sure.
Like, there are very educated people here. Samira travels to the UK around the 1940s, kind of a rough time, and she collaborates with several researchers to make further advancements in physics. With her colleagues, she developed an equation that would help explain how to generate X-rays using cheaper and more affordable means. In 2022, an Inside Arabs article said her research laid the groundwork for a revolution in the affordability and safety of nuclear medicine. So that's like just recently people are writing about her. She focused on the medical application of radiation and shortening patient X-ray exposure and making them more mobile and more flexible. There are no records that indicate exactly where she was during the bombing or the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but the timeline suggests she was still in the UK. Okay, now let's talk a little bit more about her career. That's like her early career X-rays. First, you should know she decided to become a nuclear researcher and believed in what is now a popular phrase, atoms for peace. Atoms for peace became popular because it was later adopted in a speech by Dwight D. Eisenhower. So even though she kind of came up with the concept about how we could use nuclear research for good rather than just weaponry. Mm-hmm. And that speech took place in 1953. She said, "My wish is for nuclear treatment of cancer to be as available and as cheap as aspirin."
Wow.
She wants to make sure everybody can get this and get better.
You know, it's so sad. It's like, because we went to weapon first, it's like so there's so much, and there's so much distrust in the technology, you know, because I've heard people talk about this and they're like, it could be such a great tool.
Oh, yeah.
But people are so afraid because it can go so terribly wrong.
Right. You know? Same with like, that's why like Chernobyl scared people off of using it for clean energy.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's actually like a completely renewable resource.
I know.
and like would limit all of our like global warming problems. Like, oh yeah. My gosh. But again, if it goes bad, it goes really fucking bad.
Yeah.
So
I mean, know it's
Chernobyl like had its meltdown in 1986 and you still can't go into the town.
Yeah.
Like that's the year I was born. I'm turning 39 this year.
Yeah.
That you won't be able to go into that town for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Because of the radiation. Crazy. Okay. So Samira helps to organize an atomic energy peace conference to which many prominent scientists are invited. The conference was organized to combat the widespread nuclear hysteria, which we were just talking about. The conference made a number of recommendations for setting up a committee to protect against nuclear hazards, like we were just talking about, for which she strongly advocated. Samira also volunteered during this time to help treat cancer patients with her new technology, like on her own. Wow. Because she was trying to be like, my mom died of this and I want to help fight for life using nuclear radiation. And this conference is the first time after World War II that Allied and Axis scientists got together in the same room to discuss something. However, the Western world now knew how to harness nuclear energy, and they wanted to keep it to themselves. So they were the peaceful atoms as a political tool to exclusive deals, right? Like they're pretending it's kind of peaceful, but they're also kind of protecting their own ass by knowing who exactly gets nuclear energy. In his book, The Wretched Atom by Jacob Darwin, he said that the West took advantage of social aspirations, anxieties, and environmental vulnerabilities, especially in the developing world. These deals were often traded as weapons for uranium, associating it with peaceful atoms, but typically it was just providing cover as a race for uranium, and it helped create this high pressure, high government security, secret lab type of society where you're hiring scientists that aren't going to release any information to the Soviet Union, and they're kind of doing the same thing, and we're in this, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis type of world. So Samira found herself among the new arms race in the early 50s. There she is, and there is so much rumor and hearsay surrounding this time in her life, it's really hard to decipher what exactly happened. Here's what we know. Samira is invited to the United States for a visit. She worked at the Institute of Radiology at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. We also know that some accounts say Samira was awarded the Fulbright Scholarship in atomic radiation, but the organization doesn't have record of that. There's also records that say she went on to research at Berkeley, the University of California, and that she connected with many prominent researchers there. Then she gets an invite to visit nuclear facilities in the U.S. In recognition of her pioneering nuclear research, she's given permission to visit this secret U.S. atomic facility. This visit raises vehement debate. I mean, the academic and scientific circles are like, she's going to be the first non-American citizen granted the privilege into this atomic facility.
Whoa.
Not just like the first woman, not like the literal first non-U.S. citizen. And she's from the Arabic world, which isn't a huge deal at this time, right?
Right. Because like we don't have the baggage of...
Right, there isn't a lot of baggage of terrorism. I will say our alliance with, like, the newly situating, like, Israeli council, that's going to cause issues because there is tension, right, okay. between the Israeli government and a lot of the Arabic slash Muslim world. Okay. So... we know that this happened, and pretty much everybody reports that it happened, and even she wrote in a letter home, I've been able to visit nuclear plants in America, and when I come back to Egypt, I will be of great service to my country and be able to serve for the cause of peace. But before she could even set foot on the premises, it has been reported that she was part of a huge security investigation. Oh, like sure. The clearance. They yeah. had to make sure mm-hmm. her clearance was set. She's not an American citizen. There's a lot of questions. Is she a spy? Mm-hmm. Is she trying to obtain information? Does she have any connections with the Soviet Union? She finally gets cleared. After going to the facility, she's offered a job in the United States, and she's offered American citizenship. So wow. that she, they're like, we want you to come here. We want you to be an American scientist. We want you to like work for our nuclear like program. Mm-hmm. But she says, Egypt, my dear homeland, is waiting for me. She wants to go home.
Yeah.
Her last moments in America are fraught with storytelling, but the basic themes are the same. Here's what you typically hear. She receives an invitation to dinner or a power plant, depending on the story, and gets driven to the event. She hops in the backseat of the car, and at one point, her driver suddenly takes a sharp turn on the Pacific Coastal Highway. The driver jumps from the car, and the car plummets 40 feet off the cliff, killing Samira. The accounts from this account say that the authorities reported the crash to be suspicious. Other accounts of this say Samira's time in the U.S. was drawing to a close and she wasn't on the Pacific Northwest. She was actually in Wyoming having like a vacation out in the mountains, you know, in like Cody, that area. And on August 15th, 1952, she's riding as a passenger, not in the backseat of a 1952 Buick. And the driver is an Air Force civilian employee who is assisting her. And they are, again, on a windy highway where the car loses control, falls into a ravine. But in this scenario, both die at the scene, and arrangements are immediately made to fly Samira back to Cairo by air. Because there are sparse details about her life, because she's an exceptional person, you know, speculation around her death is super common, and it is like really difficult for many generations of people to separate fact from fiction, because news sources are alleging that she saw the U.S. nuclear secrets and turned down a job and then was killed before leaving the country.
Why? I don't understand why they don't even know where she died. This is not the 1800s.
No, this is the 1950s.
This is the 50s. What is going on? That's so upsetting.
It's really upsetting. It's like some people are like, no, it was like an Israeli assassin. Some people,
okay,
that's no. far-fetched. Some people are like the U.S. had her killed. Some people are like it was an unfortunate accident, which it may have been. But when I was talking to producer about it this morning, I was like, I don't really know exactly how I want to tell the story, because like I want to believe it was just an accident. And he was like, but it is so likely that they just had her killed.
It's interesting because...
And he's the logical one. Yeah, yeah.
There's that like Occam's razor thing where it's yeah. like the simplest explanation. And like, honestly, in this case, the simplest explanation is that she was murdered because of the yeah. things that she saw. Like that Let's actually end it. Is.
She turned down a job. Let's yeah. not let her go home.
Because if it truly was an accident, like I feel like in order to like clear them of any suspicion, they would have been like, here are the exact details. But like I can't wrap my head around the fact that like they're not, like there are multiple stories and multiple locations.
Yeah,
like that's crazy.
Like the reports of where she died, how many people died.
Is her dad still alive? Like does he
he's not now.
No, not no, now, but like
this
happened,
was he... I believe. Yes.
Oh my
god. Yeah, because like, she's writing home to her family.
Can you imagine how frustrated he is?
So crazy. Like my daughter went away on this scientific journey to this amazing country that just helped win World War II. She spent time in the UK. He's probably thinking she's safe. She's amazing. She's going to change the world. And now she's just dead.
And either... he is not granted any concrete answers.
No answers. No peace. Either way, she's 35 years old.
35.
And one of the brightest nuclear minds in the world is killed. She's honored immediately in Egypt, obviously, by the army, by the Order of Sciences and Arts. There are labs in her villages named after her. There's eventually a TV series about her called The Immortal. She was honored on Egyptians' Women's Day. There are books published about her. But when we just, like, strip away all the confusion about her death, one of the books or articles said about her, in a generation, role models can really inspire, empower, and support students who share their background by showing them what is possible and how to achieve it. And like by looking at a woman like this and knowing that she was silenced in some way and then immediately like swept under the rug to the fact that we don't even know the details is hard, because this professor goes on to talk about how representation allows young emerging minds to visualize themselves in a position. Mm-hmm. And studies show that students that have teachers that are of the same racial and ethnic background it increases student achievement in those classrooms because of motivation and expectations. At present, there are only 20% of U.S. physicists are female, 20%. And it'll probably take another century for it to be 50-50. Mm. In the world, only 35% of STEM students are women. And in the world, they occupy only 28% of research and development jobs. The lack of representation makes it really difficult for female students to identify with successful women in the field. And Samira's story could have been that. You know, she is an Egyptian woman with this absolute incredible mind that comes from this incredible, like, historic region. I feel like we have a lot of historians from Egypt, yeah. You know, because it is such a, like, Egyptology is such a loved field. But to have this physicist, she could have gone on to win a Nobel Prize, this woman. And I think I know, like, the stuff surrounding her death is so interesting and like draws you in, but I think the best part about telling Samira's story is that she was brilliant.
Yeah.
She was patriotic and she was a really powerful woman. She laid the groundwork for X-ray treatment, for cancer treatment in radiation. And I venture to say most people listening to the show know somebody whose life was saved
yeah.
by chemo radiation, mm-hmm. know somebody who got an X-ray for really cheap when they were like down bad with like a broken wrist.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she also saw the good in scientific discovery, which I think a lot of governments and a lot of men who run those governments, they don't always see the good. They see the price tag mm-hmm. and how to weaponize it. So for all those reasons, I think we should celebrate Samira, who obviously has gone way, way too soon.
Yeah.
And I know that was a short story, but my God, like... We don't even know about her life.
Yeah.
She didn't even get a chance. She wrote some articles, but she didn't get a chance to finish any of her books.
That's so upsetting.
She's so young.
Ugh, gosh. All right. Well, we need to talk about them together. In a little segment we like to call
Just the Two of Us.
It's interesting to me that there is so much unknown about the beginning of Nell's life and so little known about the end of Samira's.
Yeah.
It's like very – and like really like there's not much known about totally either of their lives, mm-hmm. really. Like it's – a lot of it is shrouded in mystery.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's because they were both existing in this world with really powerful forces at mm-hmm. work. And it's like, you know, I guess Nell is in like this restoration mm-hmm. period in England after these civil wars and all this like Protestant Catholic reform and stuff. And Samira is living in a post-World War II society. So mm-hmm. a lot of their story is tangled up in government politics instead yeah. of like being specifically about the person. So it's fraught with inaccuracies.
Right. Well, because... How are you treated when you're trying to use power for good, but you're working in an innately corrupt and power hungry system, which mm-hmm. both of them are. It's yeah. like we want to think that people are looking for the good of humanity, the thing that will do the most good and, you know, help the most people. But really, especially right now, it's only getting worse. You know, it's like the goal for so many big organizations that have power is how can we make more money for the people at the very top?
Right.
And it's, you know, and then like hearing these two stories, I'm like, it's just always been the same. Mm-hmm. And it's so frustrating. And then you have these two women at the center of these stories who are doing And I think this is a great commonality. They are doing way more than what is expected of them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I also like that both of them are like really aware of that fact. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think either of them are taking what is going on lightly. You know, they are both just like, yeah, like I am just going to take every opportunity that comes my way because like none of this was like on paper with me supposed to happen.
Yeah. And like they were both also willing to go toe to toe with Big Power.
For sure.
Like I'm going to tell you, no, I don't want this job. Yeah. I'm going to say, hey, keep your dick in your pants. Maybe that's the issue.
Right.
Like to leaders of the world. Right. Yeah. And I think one interesting thing though is like, Nell was doing her most good for the people of England by remaining a kept woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that Samira turning down the job and the citizenship in the U.S. was her being like, I am not going to be a mistress of the U.S. I am going to go home to my country that needs me, and I'm going to do the research there.
Yeah. Well, it's also both of them are such great symbols of visibility and what that can do. Mm-hmm. You know, Nell was so inspiring to people, just like even like, and you wouldn't think that a mistress is inspiring, but like it was for people to be like, wow, you are a child prostitute. You are now like the favorite mistress of the king. You have your own house.
Literally your slept your way to the top.
Son is a duke. Yeah. Like what? Like
that's the dream though, like, right? Like get there.
Yeah.
By any means, right? Like by any means.
Right. And I feel like Samira was, could it like, and like, is that, you know, just like this symbol of like, yeah, like I am here and like, you can do it too, you know? And that's also why she was like reaching back into the past and being like, there are more people like me who can also be symbols for people. Mm-hmm. And like, let's bring them into the limelight and just show people that they can do more than what is expected of them.
Right. And I mean, also like one of the saddest things of both these stories is gone at 35 and 37.
I know.
Like these women were really like forces of good. And we just don't know how much good they could have done.
I thought that. I said, how many people did Nell help in just her short 37 years, you know, by doing some of the things that she did? And how many people could Samira have helped?
Yeah.
Because again, like you need those people who cannot be bought. I think that's why she was so dangerous to them, is because she couldn't be bought. Like, she was like, no, I'm working for something of a higher purpose. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what both of them had, was just like this higher purpose, no matter how much you respected or didn't respect, you know, their chosen careers. It's like they had that. And I think that's why they felt so strongly in what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we talk about shame a lot, and I love that, like, Nell was like, yeah, I don't feel shame about this at all. Yeah. You know, like, and I like that she's like, yeah, whatever. I'm a Protestant whore. And I will do the most good that I can with that title.
Yeah, I agree. I think that both of them at a young age, like, well, it's interesting. It's like Nell, like, caught her whale, like mm-hmm. you said. And I just think that the world being so different, you know, 300 years in the future, 300, mm-hmm. 400 years in the future, like it was still out of reach.
Yeah.
And you can even tell by like the number of pictures that exist of each of them. Mm-hmm. Like there aren't really pictures of Samira
mm-hmm.
because she wasn't like famous enough yet. Yeah. You know, she would have gotten there. I have faith she would have gotten there, but you know, she wasn't yet in the palm of the king.
Mm-hmm. She hadn't caught her whale yet.
No, not yet.
And then the shark killed her.
Yeah. The literal orcas came and wore her as a hat. Crazy.
All right. Well, who would you like to toast this evening?
Just those with two short lives.
Yeah.
We see it a lot, not only on the show, but in day-to-day life. You know, I see news stories or like Facebook things of people passing away that are just so young, and mm-hmm. it, like, as I'm getting older, the people are younger than me now. Like, both of these women were younger than me.
Yeah.
And it's just so, so heartbreaking mm-hmm. that, like, they're gone.
Yeah.
Like, man, mm-hmm. I could have picked some other ones. Let's trade them out.
Cheers. I'm going to toast the women who are grateful every step of the way. I just feel like every time Nell reached a new thing, she was like, this is awesome. Like,
yeah.
She was just excited to be a freaking orange girl in the theater. Like, she's like, this is so much better than being assaulted by men and selling oysters in the hot streets. And I just feel like every step she was like grateful and thankful and like, but also like didn't let that stop her from taking opportunities. Because I think it also, it can breed some complacency. But I feel like she was just like, yeah, I'm going to keep taking the opportunities, but also be thankful for where I'm at. So cheers to Nell.
Woo! Right.
What are you enjoying in pop culture this week?
So I might have promoted him before, but I really want to promo comedian Josh Johnson. I think he is...
I've never even heard of him.
Okay, so Josh Johnson is a comedian that, like, he does, like, stand-up shows around the country, but he doesn't do a set and perfect it. It's, like, very specific and very political. So, like, his stand-up will change from night to night on the tour depending on what happened in the news the day, day or week before.
Wild.
So sometimes when I want to get, and it'll be about pop culture news and, like, like political news, and it will be done in such a funny way with like metaphors and analogies that it's like, oh, I understand now what you're talking about. So like after the women's space journey went up, it was 11 minutes they were in space. Within 2 days, he had a 45 minute set. Like, you can find it on YouTube.
That's crazy.
And like a 45 minute set explaining it in the funniest way.
Yeah.
Same thing with the Elon and Trump fight. Yesterday, 52 minute stand up came out.
I love
and he
that.
Just does it on stage. Nobody knows what to expect.
Wow.
Because he's just going to talk about the news.
That's impressive.
It is impressive. And he started on The Daily Show.
Okay.
So, like, he has a political background.
Yeah.
He's so funny. He's so awkward. and I just, like, find him to be cute. So, his name's Josh Johnson. And if you haven't listened to any of his stuff,
I haven't.
Go to YouTube and just, like.
Oh, I've seen him before. He has popped up on my Instagram.
He is so funny, Katie.
Okay.
On the way home, like, pick one to listen to.
Yeah, I will. Perfect. Except I probably won't because I'm listening to Ina Garten's book
right now. Oh, gosh, yes. And I- Stick to that.
And right when she's meeting Jeffrey.
Okay.
And I'm really into it.
They're so in love.
So maybe I'll be promoting it next week.
Okay, we'll see. What are you into?
This week, I am promoting green ice cubes. So I was in Target the other week and I saw in the frozen section, well, because it's smoothie season for me. You know, I change my breakfast based on the season.
Crazy.
And right now it's smoothie season.
Right.
So I saw this thing because I always put like greens in my smoothie, like kale or spinach or whatever. And I saw this thing where like they were selling these like blocks of like compact frozen greens to put in your smoothie and just put one of those in the smoothie. And I was like, wow, that's so cool. But I was like, God, it's like $7 for these blocks. I'm like, that's crazy. And then I was thinking about it. I was like, I could probably just make them. So I literally just put kale and spinach in a blender with a little bit of water and I just blended it and then froze it. And now I just pop these ice cubes of greens into my smoothie every morning.
That makes it so much easier for
it's
you.
It's so much easier.
Really smart.
So I did, if you're a smoothie person and you want an easy way, because also greens, especially in the summertime, they go bad so quickly. The spinach gets slimy.
I always wonder about how people do stuff like that every day.
And let me tell you, I have a special box that I bought to put the spinach in to keep it from wilting. And it just doesn't matter. It keeps getting slimy.
It's too hot.
So anyways.
Green ice cubes.
Honestly, yeah. Just throw it all right when you get it into the thing. It'll last so long. It's really improved my mornings.
That's great.
Because then I'm like, yeah, I'm getting my greens first thing.
Love it.
It's exciting.
So healthy for you.
Yeah, I love it. So anyways, that's what I'm promoting.
Well, thank you everybody for tuning in yet again. We are inching close to the end of this season. Yeah. We'll take a week break when I go to France. Mm-hmm. But the last episode of this season is our 300th episode. Can you believe that?
No.
Can you believe it? Our 300th regular season episode. And I just like in my brain can't believe that's a thing. That means 600 women. So please like inch towards it with us. We'll like find out something cute or fun to do to like celebrate because it'll be probably the end of July when we'll be about to be leaving for our summer vacation.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll record something special. Mm-hmm. It's just been such a blast. Yeah. And join us everywhere on Patreon. We get a little personal. We talk a little bit about extra stuff. And we're on all of your socials besides X.
Yeah.
We, you know, we do daily updates of like just something random that happened in women's history. And then Katie updates with our cocktails and our episode each week. So you can follow along with all the stuff we're doing.
Yeah. It's just the best. But most of all, we want you to never forget that well-behaved women
live past 35.
Yeah. And they rarely make history. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.